You're listening to Scopes Monkey Choir. Music in a rational universe.
Welcome to Scopes Monkey Choir.
Hi, I'm Hai Ting.
I'm Matt.
And this is episode 27.
Episode 27, which I am calling the episode where computers suck. We've been having some internet problems here, and boy, I tell you, researching a podcast without the internet, it's like reading one of the three books that are in your house and it doesn't tell you what you want to know.
Actually, I found some books in our house that told me a great deal about what I wanted to know.
Well, anyway, I'm mad at computers.
And then I was limited to it.
So there are various things. We don't really have any news items this week. We're going to do all that next week because we just...
Well, we have a news item. We have this study about Maria Callas.
Right, which is technically left over from last week. I think it's okay.
You didn't have to tell them that.
Well, I think it's good to say it because...
It was because Sarah Englis was so interesting. We just didn't have time.
We didn't have time. So, we're going to start this out with little Maria Callas in the background, and then yes, bye.
Study by some scientists at the University of Babes Boyal. I'm sorry, I have absolutely no idea how that's pronounced.
It's really good with a little crushed pepper.
In Romania, it's called Emotions Induced by Operatic Music. Psychophysiological Effects of Music, Plot, and Acting, : A Scientist's Tribute to Maria Callas. And this seemed like one of those studies where you think, oh my gosh, somebody got money to do that? Similar to those studies where they spend a while showing straight men pictures of naked women and proving that they like to look at them. But this is, not quite as racy as that. This is just a study of people listening to opera, and the scientists tried to pick apart the emotional effects of the three major elements of opera,
mm-hmm.
the music and the plot,
mm-hmm.
and the acting.
Which is the visual part.
Yes,
right? Yeah.
Yes. So although they concentrated on the idea of the acting rather than the sets and the costumes and things. But I don't know how they could possibly separate it. So basically what they did is they played for a bunch of people an excerpt from Tosca with Maria Callas and Tito Gobbi, I think. Definitely with Maria Callas, who, by the way, was the person who first made me interested in opera in my early 20s. So that caught my eye when I saw mm-hmm. the title of this article, that it's a scientist's tribute to Maria Callas. So they played people this excerpt from Tosca, and then they had them read a plot summary and listen to the excerpt again, and then they had them watch a video of it while still listening to the music, a video with subtitles. And while they did this, they measured their heart rate and their respiration rate and their skin conductivity,
mm-hmm.
which is what you do in a polygraph.
Right.
And they found pretty darn predictable results that when just listening to the music, they had an emotional reaction that was kind of like just a generalized emotional reaction, joyful, moved. And their heart rate went up, but their respiration went down, and so did their skin conductivity, which I find that kind of interesting, actually. What does that mean? It means you're excited, but you don't breathe as fast, and also you're less stressed, because usually skin conductivity goes up when you're angry or fearful or surprised. So it goes down when you're less stressed, I think. Anyway,
I don't know.
Maybe they were just all lying about what their emotions were.
Right.
This is
a study about how opera lovers are liars.
Basically. And then after they showed them the plot summary. They basically had the same physiological reactions, but they reported their emotions as now sad because the plot was sad.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they watched the whole thing, the physiological responses were actually heightened, and they reported their emotions as having changed from either joyful or sad to transcendent was the word they used. I don't know if that's a bad translation from some Romanian word that we don't have any word for.
Right.
But in any case, so this is basically just kind of like...
Oh, and they had a control, right?
They had a control of people group of people who just listened to the music three times. Yes.
Yeah.
And their reported emotion did not change. So it seems like kind of a silly study, but I was actually interested.
Well, basically, they basically proved that multimedia is better than unimedia.
Well, better. That it that it changes our emotional reaction. That's the thing, is it didn't necessarily change very much the level of emotional response, but it changed the quality of emotional response.
Right.
I don't know if this shows us anything.
I don't know if it does either.
But they got paid money to show a bunch of people the second act of Tosca.
Yeah.
So maybe they've created some more opera fans. I was actually everyone just counts. I was just actually interested in the purely physiological responses, that in listening to opera, your heart rate could go up, but your respiration go down. I find that, I don't know how that works, I find that fascinating. I wonder if it has something to do with listening to people sing long phrases, that you actually hold your breath along with the singer.
Oh, maybe, yeah. You have like
they
a
didn't say
sort of empathetic
about that. I wasn't able to
mirror read neuron response or something.
Yeah. Doesn't it seem weird? Like if your heart rate went up, you would probably be faster.
So. Yeah.
Normally?
I guess so.
Anyway, that's probably not particularly interesting, but there you are.
Yeah,
a scientist's tribute to Maria Callas.
Mm-hmm.
For anyone who wants to know, I believe that the video of Tosca that they used, and that was the 1964 Covent Garden one with Tito Gobbi, that you can see easily on YouTube by...
Tito Gobbi.
I love Tito Gobbi.
Tito Gobbi.
It's 1964, Maria Callas and Tito Gobbi.
So, what does Maria Callas Tosca use when she makes sound?
Magic?
No, Dragon.
No, you mean not specifically Maria Callas, but opera singers in general.
I was, you know, attempting a segue.
Oh, okay. So we're going
The voice. All about the voice.
We're going to talk about how your voice works, and a little more specifically about how the singing voice works. But let's start with the basics of how your voice works, which everybody probably knows, is the vocal cords vibrating, and then the rest of your pharynx being manipulated to change the sound of what's coming out. So let's start with the idea of the vocal cords, which cords is a bit of a misnomer because they are not strings in there. They are kind of flat folds of, well, they're not even folds. They're like flat tissues with an edge that is a little bit cord-like because it has some stringy tissue in it, and that's the edge of the vocal cords that comes together to vibrate. But they don't really,
they're not cords.
They're not quite chords.
No, they're not chords at all.
Well, you know, it's funny. They we'll get into this. They are kind of cord-like because they have this edge that is a bit stringy, but then it's attached by a membrane to the outside of the larynx. Let me do some terms here. Okay, so the voice box, which is the larynx, the common name is the voice box, and the scientific name is the larynx. And this is what your vocal folds are contained in. And it basically consists of three cartilages, and you can see the biggest one, the thyroid cartilage, is what appears as the Adam's apple on men, and you can also see it on women, although it's not as prominent. You can kind of see what it looks like if you take your hands, hold them out in front of you, and put the fingertips together. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of triangular, open towards you, with the thumbs up, and the thyroid cartilage is basically shaped like that, like a V.
Mm-hmm.
And that tip that your fingers make is what sticks out as the Adam's apple. The thumbs are kind of in the place of the arytenoid cartilages, which are two separate cartilages.
Arachnophobia.
No, there are no spiders in your vocal cords. Occasionally frogs, but no spiders. So the arytenoids are these two little cartilages that kind of sit there close to the separated tongs of the thyroid cartilage. And then there's another kind of ring-shaped cartilage under the thyroid, which is called the cricoid, and basically everything just kind of sits on the cricoid mm-hmm. cartilage. Okay, so the vocal cords, if you were to string a couple of rubber bands between your thumbs and the tips of your
mm-hmm.
pointer fingers.
Your hand still being in the V shape.
Yeah, your hand being in this V shape pointing away from you. That's approximately where the edges of the vocal cords would be. And then there would be a membrane that connected, like where the webbing of your hands between your
mm-hmm.
thumb and forefinger is, if it connected to those rubber bands that you strung between your fingertips and your thumbs.
Trying to,
You were gonna, shoot it at the person sitting across from you who is making funny sounds. That's where those rubber bands are. So, you have a membrane that connects that rubber band to your hand. That's the vocal fold, and the place where the rubber band is where I said there's stringy tissue, which mm-hmm. when you actually look at it with a scope, a laryngoscope, they actually look kind of pearly white. That edge of the vocal cords, and they do kind of look like cords.
Uh-huh.
So
now, am I right that there's a lot of mucus involved too? Like the vocal folds have are mucus.
Well, I think there's a little confusion because all those tissues in there are called mucous membranes.
Mm-hmm.
And they are not entirely constituted of snot.
Like most things in the universe.
They're not entirely constituted of mucus, but they're covered in mucus, mucosa. Right.
And that's important for the vibe, for actually making the sound, right?
Well, it's important for how the sound sounds.
Okay. And that's why singers are always drinking and such.
Yeah, and talking about their mucous membranes.
Yeah.
But let's just finish out this.
They do all the time, by the way.
This little anatomy lesson.
Yeah.
So if you have those two rubber bands, you can bring your thumbs together and make the rubber bands mm-hmm. come together in the center. That's what happens when you phonate or make a noise with your vocal cords. So they come together, and remember, there's a membrane connecting them to your hand. So it's like two sheets of plastic or something coming together, and then with your lungs, you create air pressure from underneath,
mm-hmm.
which pops open the space between the vocal folds. But then the pressure of the passing air then brings them back together immediately. So it's like any double reed sort of vibration. The air both moves the two things apart and then brings them together again.
Because of a pressure difference.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's how they end up vibrating.
They end up vibrating.
Right.
And at the pitch level at which we're talking, it's for men somewhere around 100 vibrations per second, and for women somewhere around 150, 200, 300, something like that. That's how the vocal cords vibrate. Now, the sound that's made by those vibrating vocal membranes, vocal folds, vocal cords is very chaotic and doesn't have a very clear pitch.
Mm-hmm.
It has a fundamental, but it has so many different vibrations in there.
So far we have the lungs are pushing air up. They're the engine of the voice, and then the larynx is then producing the actual sort of vibrational buzzing. If you were to lop off the rest of the head, and you just had lungs, blowing air through the through the vocal folds,
yeah,
you would end up, basically it would be like if you've ever taken the mouthpiece off a trumpet and just played it without the trumpet, you'd get like a kind of sound. It's a similar kind of thing where it's kind of a tone, but it's a little chaotic. It's and doesn't yeah, to the ear it doesn't really sound like music per se.
Yeah, it's even maybe more like if you take the just the mouthpiece off an oboe or a bassoon, that kind of little quacky sound.
Yeah. Okay.
Because, well, I guess it's about the same. It's two things coming together and apart to right. create a vibration.
All right, so now let's put the rest of your head okay. back on top.
So okay. put your head back on.
speaking of lopping off your head listening to our podcast, which is never recommended, what is recommended for this is playing along at home. Please do try this at home. With all these vocal things...
Don't try lopping off your head at home.
No, I'm saying don't lop off your head, but do sing along or talk along with these vocal things. When you hear the details of the way your voice works, you can actually feel a lot of these things. And while we were researching this, there was a lot of us walking around going, trying to feel like all these little details going on in your head. So play along at home.
Okay. So that was the larynx. And as you mentioned, there are the lungs underneath. the place where your vocal folds touch is called the glottis. People probably know the epiglottis because it's that thing that keeps you from choking.
Mm-hmm.
But it epi means above, I believe. And what it's above is the glottis, which is the place where your vocal folds come together. So you might also know that when you swallow, your epiglottis covers the larynx. It seals it off so that food and water and stuff can't get down in there because the food and water is going down your esophagus, which is behind your windpipe.
Right.
An interesting evolutionary biological fact is that we're adult humans, well, grown humans are the only mammals, or the only animals really, that have this arrangement where you have to cover the trachea.
Right.
Most animals have the larynx quite a bit higher in the throat so that it connects directly to the nasal passages.
Mm-hmm.
And stuff that comes in through your mouth, liquid or food, goes around the larynx and directly into your esophagus.
Right.
So you don't risk choking when you eat. This
right.
is why we choke. And babies, until I've seen figures between 3 and 9 months, have that arrangement where the larynx is very high in the throat and can connect directly to the nasal passage. So babies can breathe and swallow at the same time, which we cannot do.
Mm,
I don't know if you've ever
cool.
tried this, but you
don't you try cannot, it. I don't think that's
cannot a, breathe and swallow at the same time. No, literally, because swallowing includes covering the trachea,
right.
the glottis, with your epiglottis, yeah. therefore cutting off your air.
No, I think it's one of those fascinating evolutionary points, because considering the number of people who choke, even in the modern world with the Heimlich maneuver and everything. people still die from choking. Like, basically, eating is kind of dangerous. And it's a testament to how extraordinarily important language is to human beings. That with all these people throughout the couple of million years that we've been talking, all the people that are, like, choking and falling over and dying and, like, just from eating... It's
they're,
still like
they're
talking.
Made up for,
is,
they're made up for by all those people standing around and saying, "Oh, he's choking to death. How fascinating!
Should we
Let's
save
go
him?
Procreate?
No, we don't really like him.
But
Let
actually,
him
I have
no,
to say
what,
that
you see what I mean. That like communication is more important than trumps the fact that you can die while you eat.
Well, I do have to say that in researching this, I noticed that a bunch of evolutionary biologists believe that the dropping of the larynx was just a byproduct of our upright stature.
Just sort of gravity took it down,
well,
as it were?
Well, no, it's because our jaws retracted into towards our trachea and our spinal cord. And that if you're arranged more like a chimpanzee, your jaw is much more forward and your larynx kind of naturally. I didn't research this carefully, but we'll put up some links maybe to, I saw a little study about the arrangement of the head and spinal column that suggests that it was simply the upright posture that gave us this advantage, and then we took advantage, or gave us this arrangement, and then we took advantage of it by using the speech sounds we could make.
Interesting.
But this is a perfect segue into the speech sounds that we can make. And the reason that the dropped larynx helps us make these sounds is that because of where the larynx is, the entire body and root of the tongue is above the glottis.
Uh-huh.
Which means that you can manipulate the shape of the mouth, the pharynx. So the pharynx is the part of the windpipe in the back of the mouth that's above the glottis and the larynx.
Okay.
So we, because the larynx is so low, can manipulate the shape of that passageway out into the air.
Uh-huh.
And that's why we can make so many different sounds. We can, in vocal pedagogy, they call them articulators. So that's the tongue and the lips and the cheeks and the soft palate. Mm-hmm. We can move all of those articulators independently and vastly change the shape of that passage, and that allows us to make all the vowels and consonants that we can. But if your larynx were up higher, only part of your tongue and none of your soft palate is in front of the larynx or above the larynx, so you
right,
have
so
much
fewer
sound, possibilities.
Yeah.
Let's get into you have a question, Matthew?
Yeah, question.
He's raising his hand for our podcast audience.
Well, I don't, when you get going, I don't want to interrupt, you know. Is there any, are any of those articulators, et cetera, all those little details, are there any of those that normally you don't have conscious control over, but when you do heavy classical training, you actually gain control over?
Well, it depends on what you mean by conscious control. We have... With normal brain function, we have an incredible amount of control over them, but it's largely subconscious.
Right.
Like, we think ooh when we get ooh. We don't think, okay, now I have to round my lips and lift my... Or round my lips and drop my tongue and raise my soft palate.
Right.
That's what you become aware of. It's like any fine motor function that you can either do it unconsciously by saying, tap that button... Or by not even, by just tapping the button.
Right,
or you can
yeah.
say, now I'm going to tense this muscle and push my finger down.
And also the larynx itself, the whole voice box, when people talk or sing, but even when you just talk, it actually moves up and down as well, right?
And the larynx?
Yeah.
Yes.
It moves up and down subconsciously. You don't think about it at all, but when you train vocally, you actually learn how to consciously move it down.
Yes, I will come back to that.
Okay.
Okay, so... I mentioned all these vowel sounds that we can make, and I mentioned in particular ooh, which I believe is one of the sounds that chimpanzees and babies cannot make.
I guess that's monkeys, not chimps.
Right. Chimps mostly go, right?
I don't know. We better look this up.
I saw as I was researching that a 3-month-old baby's arrangement of larynx and tongue is approximately equivalent. Is quite equivalent to a chimp's,
uh-huh.
and they can make the same number of sounds, same number of vowel sounds, and it's very few.
Mm. Right,
so
we'll
let me talk about
this,
let me talk about the vowel sounds. So, vocal cords are vibrating, and the pharynx is the pharynx and vocal tract. The vocal tract, I'll call it the vocal tract. So mm-hmm. it's the part of your head, face, mouth, nose that is above the glottis. It is basically, if you think of it, it's sort of like a trumpet. If your vocal cords were the vibrating lips, and then the rest of your vocal tract is the trumpet. Now, a trumpet is made of stiff steel, and so
or brass
rather. Yes, I'm sorry, brass instrument, right?
Right.
So. It kind of vibrates in a simplistic way and helps to create a pure pitch out of the vibration that's happening. Mm-hmm. But your vocal, your head, the stuff inside yeah. your mouth and your nose is soft. And so it doesn't have the same kind of bounce back mm-hmm. of sound waves. But nonetheless, it's similar in that what you're doing with creating a sound wave is you're creating a pressure wave, which is called a longitudinal wave. And I believe that the last time I referred to this, I used the incorrect name of the wave. I think I said transverse wave, which Ooh. Is actually the up and down wave that you get in a string. But a longitudinal wave is, I'll say this one more time. I said it in the episode on the harmonic series, but it's a cool metaphor or a cool illustration. If you take a slinky and you attach it to a doorknob, you stretch it out and you hold the other end, you can either make a wave by moving it up and down, mm-hmm. thereby creating a kind of up and down wave, mm-hmm. or you can pull it in and out. And then that's a longitudinal wave. So you're basically sending more waves of more compressed slinky coils and less compressed slinky coils, mm-hmm. For which the technical term is compression, where there are more, and rarefaction. Mm. I went off on that word yeah. another podcast because I love it. Rarefaction. So waves of compression and rarefaction, that is a longitudinal wave. That's what a sound wave is. Instead of slinky coils, it's air particles. Okay, so that's what you're setting up inside your mouth or inside the trumpet. You're setting up a longitudinal wave, and it's compressed and rarefied air. and it has a certain wavelength. Now, with the trumpet, the wavelength is, for various physics reasons, it's the wavelength is twice as long as the trumpet. So there's half a wavelength in the trumpet.
Right.
That's the fundamental. And that is the same in your voice. In the trumpet, you then have divided in ratios, smaller waves that set up the harmonic overtone series.
Right.
Now, in your because your mouth is soft tissues and it's more complicated, the overtones are not in perfect ratios like that. They're very complex.
Mm-hmm.
And also because the vocal cords are soft, squishy tissue, they create a really chaotic wave. Apparently, if you record and graph out the overtones for the sound that vocal cords make,
right.
It's kind of a what would you say, like a falling off wave form like this.
The higher the tone, the quieter it is, right?
Yes.
The higher
so
the
it has lots of overtones, and they basically kind of the volume of them drops off in a curve mm-hmm. away from the fundamental, but they're not in nice ratios the way right. they are in a trumpet.
Right.
So they're kind of all there.
Well, I'd like to also just point out that one reason also is that that it happens this way is that the trumpet is designed right. and your voice and your head is evolved, and it's not evolved to be some sort of, it's not evolved to be an instrument. It's evolved to be a thing that will survive and have kids.
As long so as it doesn't choke and die.
Exactly.
So basically you have all these overtones available that your vocal cords are making. Now, the shape of your vocal tract from the glottis up can emphasize different
overtones.
Wavelengths within this series.
I just want to, just very, very briefly, for those who didn't hear the harmonic series, I just want to say that what we're talking about here is that whenever you make a sound, you hear, your ear hears you hear that note, but there's actually a lot of other notes there. They're just quieter. And this is just a physical property of the way sound works. And so that's what we're talking about when we say overtones.
Yes. Okay. So as I was saying, you get all these many, many overtones that are within the basic fundamental tone this chaotic tone that your vocal cords are producing, and your vocal tract can be reshaped to resonate sympathetically with different parts of this series of overtones to emphasize. Yes.
I think it'd be good to do an example here. I'll just do the vowels on the same note. So that's all the same note, and that's one, by the way, I recommend trying at home, because you can really, you can really sort of feel, you can feel actually how much your mouth and all the muscles around your mouth are changing a lot just between one and two vowels. Like you have to make a lot of adjustments, and you do them all the time without thinking about it, but try it out, feel it.
And so basically what's happening is when you're changing the shape like that, different areas are they're basically like the size of some of these waves. And mm-hmm. so they're sort of multiplying the sound that particular wavelength can make, mm-hmm. multiplying the energy that it can gather before it comes out and reaches somebody else's ear.
Therefore emphasizing it.
Yes. And so the areas of the wavelength that are the pitches that are emphasized for each sound that you make are called formants.
Right.
So that's a particular area of that harmonic series spectrum that is emphasized with each vowel.
Yeah.
And it's different from the pitch that you're singing. It's higher than the pitch you're singing. And there are several. Usually in speech, they talk about three formants, first, second, and third formants. There are more. There's sort of like little bumps in the overtone series.
Right. So once again, I want to make sure I understand. So when I do a, do those two different syllables, I'm singing the same note, but by moving my mouth and tongue around, and by changing, sort of without even having to think about it, by changing the shape of my head, basically, I'm actually emphasizing different overtones.
Yes.
And that's why it sounds different.
Yes.
It's the same note, but it sounds different because different harmonics are being emphasized.
Yeah, and you're technically actually changing what those overtones are, because the way the wave is set up in your mouth, what you're doing is constricting or widening different parts of the passage.
Mm-hmm.
And the wave, because it's this series of compression and rarefaction of air molecules, mm-hmm. when you constrict or widen a certain passage, then the extra air molecules have to move faster or slower in order to make a wave through that area.
Mm-hmm.
And so they move at different speeds because of the narrowing or widening of the tube through which they're moving.
Mm-hmm.
So you can do that at different areas of the vocal tract. You can do it at the lip area. Ooh. Or ah. You can make it really a small opening or a wide uh-huh. opening. Which changes the way. Which changes the.
Oh, yeah, that's just lips changing.
Just lips, yes. Uh-huh. You can do it with the tongue in the middle of the mouth. So you can lift or lower your tongue, lifting. Or lowering. And you can do that without. Yeah, you can do that without changing the shape of your lips. And then there's the back of the throat, which is both the back of the tongue and the soft palate. So you can. Constrict the back of your throat in various ways. You can do it from the sides, or you can do it from the soft palate, or you can do it from the back of the tongue.
Mm-hmm.
You can also, just to let everybody know, the soft palate, which is that soft part in the back that lifts when you yawn, when you lift it, it actually closes off your nasal passages.
Mm-hmm.
But it means that when you sing with your palate lifted, no air is coming out your nose.
Uh-huh.
It is only coming out your mouth. Whereas usually when you talk, some air is coming out your nose. And certainly if you're French, some air is coming out your nose. Ha ha. That's what they mean with a nasal vowel. It means that your soft palate is dropped, so some air is coming out your nose, huh. and the nasal passages and the sinuses are also resonating. They're also part of the instrument.
I was going to ask you about that. Now, the you so far have been talking mainly about the things that affect the sound, and the tone of a voice that you can control.
Yeah.
But aren't there also things just about the shape of an individual head, which resonate and in a certain way that causes people to have distinct voices because they're all slightly different?
Absolutely, because everybody's tongue, soft palate, cheeks, lips, teeth, larynx are all shaped differently.
Mm-hmm.
There's only so much manipulation you can do. Everybody's has a particular sound. And in fact, most people also have a distinctive formant series. Now that we can record and carefully analyze the various frequencies that are in a sound, people actually use this for forensic evidence, mm-hmm. for recorded voices, that everyone's formants, the peaks in those harmonic overtone series, are extremely distinct.
Wow.
They're like fingerprints. So you can, it's part of voice analysis to analyze the formants. The formant pattern.
Mm-hmm. I don't remember seeing that used on CSI.
Yeah, it's too complicated to explain. I haven't even really been able to do it here.
Maybe in, like, I don't know, CSI Venice. They'd get into it.
CSI Venice. That's good. Okay, so while we're on formants, let's talk about a couple of particular formants. I was talking about the first, second, and third formants. One of them is changed at the lips, one of them is changed in the middle of the mouth, and one is changed in the back of the mouth. And various combinations of these things allow us to distinguish allow our ears to distinguish the vowels.
Mm-hmm.
And so, for instance, a dropped tongue and a closed and a small lips and an open throat, I believe, comes out, ooh. If you lift your tongue with the same arrangement, otherwise you get ü,
which is when you start sounding European.
Mm-hmm. Likewise, ah is open mouth, dropped tongue, constricted throat.
Ah,
I think, or maybe open throat. And right. So the combination of these three areas is what allows us to distinguish vowels. It is, mm-hmm. also what we can do that chimpanzees can't, because we have those three areas. also why babies, very small babies, always sound like they're making the same vowels.
Yeah.
This becomes really interesting when you sing, because those formants have a particular pitch that they happen at. The formants that allow us to distinguish vowels one from the other.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, the frequencies at which men and women talk, men, it's somewhere between 100 and 200 hertz.
Right.
And for women, somewhere between 150 and 300, I think, for speech, regular speech. So the formant series works really well. Above that, the vowel formants have particular pitches that are above those. Now, when you start singing in a higher range,
mm-hmm.
the frequency at which you want your ear needs the formant in order to distinguish the vowel becomes lower than the fundamental pitch that you're singing. I forget exactly where it is, but so I'll demonstrate. If you sing up here. Or you can kind of distinguish the ah and the e.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little bit false because you have to, in order to get that sound to resonate nicely, you have to open your mouth quite a bit. So you have to sort of fake the e by lifting your tongue, and the ear can basically distinguish ah from e. But if you get a little bit higher, that that was ah and e as best I can at that pitch, and you can't really distinguish it.
Oh,
because so your when you, ear when you
get up
have...
high, when you get up high like that, you sort of physically are unable to create certain vowels.
Exactly.
Wow. Yeah,
because you actually because you couldn't make an overtone. That's in because the overtone that your ear would need is lower than the fundamental pitch that's being produced.
Wow.
So that's why all the vowels blend together really high. And you can do various tricks. People can do various tricks to kind of trick people into thinking that they're hearing a certain vowel, but they're not the same vowels that you hear at spoken pitch. Now, there's another interesting singer formant thing. When you were talking earlier about the dropped larynx.
Blah.
Right. Which most of us don't really... Can you pick that up, please? mostly when we talk, we raise the larynx a little bit. I'm not exactly sure why.
Because we get all excited and then the larynx just...
Yeah, I really don't know why. Maybe because that's just its natural placement. But if you allow it to drop down far enough, for some reason... Some mystery of physics, the little area in those cartilages that you made earlier with your hands, if you were not driving or doing something else with your hands, or in a public place where people would think you're really weird. Okay, so that little thing you made that approximated the
voice
larynx
box.
Or voice box, mm-hmm. those three cartilages, if you drop it far enough down away from the rest of the pharynx, that little thing can set up its own standing wave. Just within the little box. And it's approximately 3,000 to 3,500 hertz, that little thing. So it makes this little high overtone whistle, which has been called the singer's formant.
And
it's at a pitch that is above any of the major overtones that an entire orchestra produces.
Right, which allows it to, with it, which allows the voice to be heard over an orchestra.
Yes, which seems impossible.
Right.
It those does little kind of tiny little vocal cords.
Yeah.
So that's one of the things that allows a trained classical singer to be heard above an orchestra.
Right.
Now, apparently there are a couple others. That was the original one that was discovered that a dropped larynx, which is part of the classical technique, produces.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, you don't need that for pop technique because you have a microphone. So apparently there are a couple of other things that can help a voice project over an orchestra. One of them is just a certain shape in that formant space that's in the back of your throat. Apparently, if you constrict it in just the right way, and there's a certain proportion that they found by doing CAT scans, while people are singing, they find that there's a certain ratio that you can make, which is like 1 to 6 for width to length. In that part of your throat, that it creates just the right overtone frequencies to really project a voice.
Hmm.
And they found that trained voices had that kind of ratio and untrained singing voices didn't. So there are all kinds of things that science is discovering about the way the voice works. One of which is... that now that we have laryngoscopes, which are little scopes that you put down your throat, all the things that voice teachers talked about for centuries are suddenly thrown into question, including the whole head voice, falsetto, chest voice thing.
Oh, yeah.
Which I'm not going to get into it now because I think we have enough of a podcast, but we can talk about it later because it's totally fascinating, and everyone is still arguing about it. But I will say that there's one version of this, which I would say that rock singers call it falsetto and classical singers call it head voice. And other people say, what the?
No, but it's okay. Not even, we but said we weren't going to get into
I
it.
I didn't know, oh. No. But there's one vocal function, and we'll both do it here in a moment, in which the vocal cords actually do not come together. So in this case, it would mean that the glottis is open in a kind of elliptical shape, and that the vocal cords really are acting more like chords because they're vibrating individually, but they're not coming together to form a stoppage of the air.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the kind of airy sound, like this.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to, which is a full closure of the glottis and maybe an overload of the
microphone. So then in pop music, you get that, oh no, no, oh
yeah,
no, no.
Exactly.
No.
Yeah.
Woo.
Yeah. So your vocal cords are never coming together in that. They're just vibrating independently.
And that's also why it's a little quieter too, presumably.
Yep, absolutely.
Very cool. So there you go, the voice. The voice, who knew it was so complicated?
Yikes. I know, that's only part of it.
We didn't even get to everything, did we?
Not even. So we are not going to touch vibrato with a 10-foot pole.
So no instrument du jour of the week this day.
Because we totally forgot it.
We just totally forgot to give you a hint. And then we decided, since we didn't give you a hint, that we'd let ourselves off the hook and... but here is a hint for next week's instrument du jour of the week.
Of the day.
Of the hour. That's it. And any announcements?
I got no more.
You got no more? Well, then, I would say thank you for listening to Scopes Monkey Choir from scopesmonkeychoir.com. We are professional musicians, but amateur scientists. If you doubt something we've said, don't believe us. Look it up yourself. Nevertheless, each episode's page at scopesmonkeychoir.com has references and citations. We welcome your feedback.
Write to scopesmonkeychoir@gmail.com if you dare. Or leave a message on the monkey phone.
347-788-0330. Bye.
Bye.